Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour,
bringing you a special feature
to mark half a century since the death of the wartime Pope, Pius XII. Then on a totally different note, I'll be joining our popular Latin lover, Father Reginald Foster, for a summer tale once written by Horace, and more famously picked up by Valteros Disney. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Next week marks a special anniversary, half a century since the death of 20th century Pope Pius XII. The exact date was the 9th of October 1958, and it brought an end to a pontificate which had begun for the former Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli on the 2nd of March 1939, almost 20 years earlier. Gone down in history as the wartime Pope, in recent years Pius XII has often been accused of alleged silence regarding the horrors of the Holocaust, but also of not doing enough to help the Jewish people survive this dramatic chapter in their lives. Are these accusations really justified? If you wish to know more about what really happened, listen on, and then make up your own minds regarding this matter.
Di persone le quali senza veruna colpa propria, talora solo per ragioni di nazionalità o di stirpe, sono destinate.
Hundreds of thousands of persons, through no fault of their own, sometimes only for reasons of nationality or race, are destined to death or to a gradual extinction.
I cui orrori noi già fin dall'inizio più volte denunziammo.
It was Christmas 1942, and war had been raging for over 3 years. Pius XII had consistently, persistently denounced the horrors of the war and of the Holocaust. His appeals for peace fell on deaf ears. His appeals for humanitarian relief did not.
The humanitarian work of Pius XII during the tragedy of World War II was extraordinary. Because the human dimensions of the greatest war of history are staggering. Millions and millions of dead. And many more millions were innocent victims of the struggle of war, violence, bombing, deportations, starvation, and all that. And from the very first day, Pius XII knew that from his experience in World War I.
Jesuit historian Father Robert Graham, foremost expert on the Vatican in World War II, helped research and write 4 volumes of correspondence focusing on the Vatican's humanitarian activity during those tragic years of war.
A non-political activity, for which now they criticize him for not being political enough. He was a non-political voice, an angel of relief for millions and millions and millions of people.
That opinion was echoed in an editorial in the New York Times of Christmas 1942.
In these circumstances, no one would expect the Pope to speak as a political leader, or a war leader, or in any other role than in that of a preacher ordained to stand above the battle, tied impartially, as he says, to all people, and willing to collaborate in any new order which will bring a just peace.
We cannot judge him in the context of today. We have to consider what the situation was at that particular time. a few of the sisters told me how frightened they were when the Nazi soldiers or the fascist soldiers would knock on the door and ask them if they had any Jews hidden.
Sister Margherita Marchione spent several years collecting testimonies from some of the thousands of Italians whose lives were saved thanks to Pius XII's strategy of action.
In three of our convents right here in the city of Rome.
This was actually something Pope Pius XII asked religious to do in those war days, wasn't
it? Yes, he did. He spread the word by word of mouth because it was impossible for him to put in the newspapers what would have happened. The Nazis and the fascists would have gone directly to all the convents and monasteries. He recommended to all the superiors of the convents and monasteries and different parishes to open the doors and to help save the Jewish refugees.
Israel Zolli, chief rabbi of Rome during those years, confirmed this in his autobiography.
The Holy Father sent by hand a letter to the bishops, instructing them to lift the enclosure from the convents and monasteries so that they could become refuges for the Jews. I know of one convent where the sisters slept in the basement, giving up their beds to Jewish refugees. In the face of this charity, the fate of so many of the persecuted is especially tragic.
So impressed was Zolli with Pius XII's zeal in helping the Jewish people that when war was over, he converted to Catholicism, taking the Pope's name, Eugenio. But Rabbi Zolli was not the only one to recognize the Pope's zeal in defending the Jewish people. In January 1945, an extreme fascist, Roberto Farinacci, lamented.
For a few years, Pope Pius XII has fully espoused the Jewish cause to the point of offending the sensibilities of his flock. We never imagined that our pastor, the Vicar of Christ, the head of the Church, could one day be regarded as the most influential defender of the interests of the Jewish people.
Rather than being a silent pope, then...
He was a pope of action, I would say.
He worked in silence.
He did. He had what I would call an underground railroad. And some authors have actually attributed saving the lives of 800,000 Jews and other refugees to Pope Pius XII himself through his representatives, who were the sisters and the priests and the monks in the different areas, and actually in the Vatican itself. Pope Pius XII was able to keep hidden in the Vatican thousands of Jews, not only in the Vatican itself, but in Castel Gandolfo. At his summer estate, for all the years of the war, Pius XII did not go to his summer estate because during that period he had these people hidden. And I have a lovely photograph, Veronica, that shows in a room of Castel Gandolfo about 20 women holding their babies in their arms and feeding them and just living in the apartments of the Holy Father.
Did you ever see any of the refugees in Castel Gandolfo? Oh,
surely, because one of my headquarters was the Papal Villa, and women with their children were actually to the beautiful crucifix in front of the Papal apartments. You'd go and you'd find women bathing their children. The staircase leading up there, on every step, there was somebody sleeping.
Monsignor Carol Abbing worked closely with Pius XII in organising a relief network for thousands of people on the battlefronts south of Rome.
We were cut off practically from Rome, any kind of regular communication. Pius XII was always he looked right through to the substance of something. And he might say, well, why are you telling me this? And he said, what do you plan to do? You see, which was logical. I'd actually not planned to do anything. And I said, well, I wouldn't even know how to begin. But I know these people, tens of thousands of people living in the caves, are desperately making little caves themselves to get underground because they're terrified. Every day, bombardments and all. Their worldly goods are all there. Their wine is in the little wine cellars. And if they move, they lose everything, as I was able to see later. So I don't know what, but I said, I think that we should have a better picture of what it is, you see.
So you're talking about thousands of people, are you?
I'm talking about thousands of people, yes. So I said, I'd just like to see what what can be done? And he said, God bless you, he said, let me know how I can help you. Without thinking of his own safety in any way, people never seem to value what happened. Were the Nazis happy about him? We say he never denounced them. It's not true. I was present every time, the New Year greetings to the diplomatic corps. And he's telling me, I used to shiver listening, and I'd look round and I'd see some of the diplomats with their drawn faces, because these words are... they might bring a thunderbolt in the next day.
If the Gestapo had crossed the border between Italy and Vatican City, they would have found refugees hiding everywhere.
In November 43, by and by the house got filled with people hiding from the Nazis for various reasons. Some because they were of Jewish race or origin, some of their political or military position. Also several young fellows, for the young people, who hide in order not to be drafted.
Eva Maria Jung Iglesias was one of those who found asylum inside Vatican City.
The college. So they were sleeping in the museum inside these ancient sarcophages. At least they were safe for a moment. And we made a service day and night round the clock of two who had to watch in case the SS would arrive. Had to be aware of this possibility that the Germans would come in, but fortunately they didn't.
And it was also from the Vatican that prisoners of war could keep in touch with their families.
Calling its correspondent in Bombay. The Vatican Radio is calling its correspondent in Sydney.
The Germans, they thought it was a source of espionage, and they would have nothing to do with it. And there was no messages from the Vatican Radio to Germany, because it was prohibited to listen to the Vatican Radio. And that was a sore point with Pius XII. As I said, they had a phobia, the Germans did, that this was an intelligence operation. Well, that just shows how little freedom of action the Vatican had in doing this charitable work. But it went ahead just the same. And it was a matter of great pride and consolation for the Pope to be able to demonstrate in this public way of his concern for the victims of war.
In England, after the war, the Illustrated London News acclaimed Pius XII as a hero. Winston Churchill's first cousin, Sir John Leslie, recalled.
I remember the Illustrated London News just after the war had a great double sheet coloured photograph of what they called Pius the Great. And it gave a resume of his life underneath. And they looked upon him as a great force for good in the war, which of course he was. And he became a hero, I'd say, the Pope, to England after the war.
And when the war was over, the Rome Jewish community hung the following notice in the city's Museum of Liberation.
The Congress of the Delegates of Italy's Jewish Communities, held in Rome for the first time after the liberation, feels profoundly the duty of directing reverent homage to your holiness, and to express the profound sense of gratitude which animates all Jews for the proof of human brotherhood furnished them by the Church during the years of persecution, and when their lives were placed in danger by the Nazi and fascist barbarity. Many times, priests suffered prison and concentration camps, sacrificing their own lives to assist the Jews by every means.
I hope you found this feature I put together for you interesting. And now stay tuned for a dramatic change of pace as it's time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, who today begins by recounting a cute tale best known perhaps for its cinematic Disney version. But as most people know, it was, point of fact, once invented by Horace. No. I want to speak about Horace, your friend Horace.
Oh, he's all right.
I read that Horace writes satires in the manner of Montaigne, the French writer Montaigne, rather than Swift. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I couldn't really compare them like that, but he writes satires like you'd talk on the street. I mean, they're like colloquial speech of satires.
That he was kind of kinder. He was not scathing or biting.
No. He's very good. No, he's very good.
How do you say scathing or biting?
Non mordet. Neque shindet.
Neque shindet?
Shindet. He doesn't rip people apart.
He focused, I believe, on studies of character.
Oh, yeah, very much. People, and this guy with this idiosyncrasy, and he does this and that. You know, a lot of people don't know this about Horace. In one of his satires, he has the famous story of the country mouse.
Can you repeat that? Because my glasses...
Horace has the story of the country mouse, no? Where the country mouse comes to the city and meets his city mouse. And the country mouse hangs around the city mouse, and after a while he says, no, and then a dog comes in and scares all the mice away. And the country mouse says, this is not for me, and he runs back to the country.
Okay, can you tell us that little story?
No,
I can't. In Latin,
no,
the country mouse and the city mouse.
Yeah, mus rusticus et urbanus. Et rusticus mus urbanum invisit murem. Visits the city mouse.
And what happens?
Eusque videt viam vivendi, his way of life, living. Et tandem aliquando repellitur.
He didn't like it.
No, repellitur omnino et exteritur a cane, moloso, by a big, huge dog, like a bulldog. Et rus recurrit, and he runs back to the country. But that's all in Horace, beautifully written. That's one of his kind of satires. Things are better in the city, and Horace says, no.
Did the Roman literary circles fear his wicked ability to make the world laugh at his enemies?
No, they didn't fear him. No, they didn't fear Horace because he wasn't that bad. They were amused by Horace.
He calls himself amica via pastoribus, or a friend to the shepherds, no? Doesn't he?
I don't know. I never heard that before. And but that's all right.
Yeah, and it seems the friend he is defending in that particular sentence is no other than the younger Virgil, because Virgil was younger than Horace.
No, Virgil's older, 5 years older than Horace. Virgil was born in 70 BC and Horace is 65 BC.
This is just rubbish. How do you say rubbish?
Rubbish. Quisquilie.
Quisquilie.
Sordes. Sordes. Trash. Sordes.
Can I quote from Horace this line which says, why do you attack innocent strangers, snarling cur that you are?
I can't remember the original of that.
You run quickly enough at the sight of a wolf. Why not attack me whose teeth are ready for you? And this is where he says, I am a friend of the shepherds, a trusty hound of Spartan kind.
My lord, this is Horace. Where are you getting this from?
I prick up my ears and drive the wild beast back to his mountain snows. You make the whole forest echo with your terrific barking. But if anyone tosses you a scrap, you stop to smell the bribe. And then here, the translation of to smell the bribe, I don't know if it's right, is projectum odorarsi citrum.
Projectum odorarsi
citrum.
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 A citrum is a...
Lemon.
Yeah, exactly. To smell the lemon for yourself having been thrown out there.
So, you stop to smell the bribe. Could be translated that way.
Well, I mean, the bribe, if you want to consider this lemon as the bribe.
How would you translate?
Well, I don't know. The bribe is the pretium or something like that. And I don't know. Boy, this is strange. I don't know why I don't recognize...
Well, let's leave it then, if you don't recognize...
No, I don't. I just don't recognize horror, so maybe I'm just kind of getting rusty. If it's I can find it in 10 seconds.
So will you translate this for me? Why do you attack innocent strangers, snarling cur that you are?
Quirtum... Canis qui es... Ringens is snarling. Ringens. Innocentes agrederis... Innocent what?
Strangers.
Innocentes agrederis extrarios, vel extraneos, vel alienígenas, there are many words for strangers, peregrinos.
You run quickly enough at the sight of the wolf.
Viso lupo, satis celeriter decurris.
Why not attack me, whose teeth are ready for you?
Me cur non pulsius agrederis, cuius tibi parati sunt dentes, whose teeth are ready for you.
I am a friend of the shepherds, a trusty hound.
Why does he get an amica in there as a feminine? What is he talking about? I don't know. Ego sum amicus pastoribus. I am a friend to the shepherds. Fidus canis fidissimus. Or fidus canis is a trusty hound. But you have something in the feminine there. Amica.
Amica, yeah.
Well, then female dog is talking. I don't know.
So that's why we call our dogs Fido.
Oh, certainly Fidus. Certainly he's a trusty, he's a trustworthy Fidus.
You don't hear dogs being called Fido anymore, but in the...
I know, but in the old days, certainly.
I prick up my ears and drive the wild beast back to his mountain snows.
Aures arigo meas. Feramque in... Into what?
His mountain snows.
Feramque in nives montanas rebello. Well, that you can say. It's not Horace, but I can say it.
You make the whole forest echo with your terrific barking.
La tratu tuo terrifico facis ut resonet silva universa. Oh, that's glorious. It's not Horace, but it's mine.
One has to think that the dog wasn't a real dog, whether it was a female dog or a male dog.
I don't know. It's amica there. It's amica. It's some. I don't know what they're doing.
Someone said that this dog was referred to someone called Furius Bibaculus.
Furius Bibaculus, yeah.
A bad poet and lampooner.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, well, a bad poet. I mean, he was one of the first new poets. When Horace was a young man, Horace was already writing, and they had like underground poets, like subculture poets, and Bibaculus was one of them.
So how does one say bad poet and lampooner?
Pessimus poeta. Mm-hmm. Atque maledicus. Maledicus would be a lampooner.
Was Horace kind to these young poets?
He wasn't just kind of mad at the world.
How do you say bitter?
Non orbi... Hominibus irasce batur. He wasn't angry at people. He just kind of made fun of some stupid things he had to do.
So if you had to put Horace in a box
and
give him three objects.
What do you mean three objects?
Like the Etruscans did, for example, with their corpses. They used to put things in. What would you throw in? Something you wrote or?
Oh, yeah, I suppose.
What?
I suppose
what?
His letters or his satires, his letters. Or his satires. That's Horace, where he talks kind of like, you know, like on the street. He talks on the street.
So what three books would you put in?
What, three books? Well, there are two books of satires and one book of letters. That's Horace. No, he's good. He's good because he talks just, you know, like colloquially.
And if you had to write his epigraph, what would you write?
Oh, my Lord.
Here lies one.
Huh?
Here lies one who?
Qui omnia lingua sua est complexus. He took everything in with his tongue or something. I don't know what. That's very hard to do. Of course, you have to think of a month about doing Horace.
And a big thank you there, as always, to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. Finally, let's take a look at some artwork pertaining to the conversion of St. Paul on the road to Damascus. In a few moments, in fact, I'll be focusing on a masterpiece by Caravaggio, housed in the Church of Santa Maria del Popolo, precisely in the far left-hand chapel as you face the high altar, explained for us briefly by Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis.
He might have started a kind of movement which encouraged painters afterwards to paint everybody, not just patrons of the arts. For example, this church in the 1400s was built under Sixtus IV, the same man who did the Sistine Chapel. So if you look at all the paintings in the Sistine Chapel, and like the Perugino's, the Cosimo Rossellis, etc., and the Botticelli's, they always have inserted in the base of all of these paintings, apart from the biblical scene or Christological scene, some figures of that period. But they would also be important figures or cardinals or relatives of popes or whatever. Caravaggio, no. Caravaggio puts the man who's working in the field or the man who's working cleaning things in the city, and a human person who has a hard time surviving. He's able to show this wonderful humanity of the suffering individual in his own life of the moment, you know. He was able to marry humanity, real humanity, to artistic beauty. This is the key to Caravaggio. And also the fact that he would put his light not necessarily on the main figure, like you would illuminate St. Paul's face or whatever. He would have lights maybe damp on the ground beside the leg of a horse. So you would have the light of the artist's mind. He would choose to put a light in a place which would automatically reflect back on another part, which maybe the other part was more important, like St. Paul lying on the ground and his horse looking dazed like what's happened to him. You know, and he's just stunned at this incredible gesture of surrender. He's lying on the ground with his hands up in the air in a state of shock to whatever has happened to him, this miracle of his conversion. It's like he was struck by God into a situation where he was converted. And you can feel the word struck here. It's not just like he, in a moment of ecstasy, when he was praying in a room or sitting in a room having dinner or sitting talking to friends, that he suddenly had this oncoming emotion about being converted.
And a big thank you there to our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, who's currently working at the American University of Rome. That brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.